$1 and sell them for 50 cents, how do you make a profit? Answer: volume. The reason, of course, is to become better known, build an audience, get more streams, play bigger concerts, and rocket yourself to stardom. As we discussed, the future of the music biz is to find ways other than radio to reach fans, and touring is still one of the best. On top of that, being on the road builds your performing skills. There are a lot of artists who explode on their first album but have a lousy live show because they haven't spent time getting their act down. So touring is a good thing. However, if you go out and lose money, who's going to pay for the loss? The answer is usually one of two possibilities. 1, a rich relative, or 2, a record company. Guess which one happens more often. Monies that record companies give you to make up tour losses are called tour support. It's defined as the actual amount of your loss. You'll be required to give accountings to the company. But of course, it has a maximum limit, usually in the range of $50,000 to $100,000 per tour for a major record company, and more like $10,000 to $15,000 for an independent label. In this era of 360 deals, the companies say they'll be more generous with tour support if you're more generous with their share of touring income. Maybe that's true. Many, if not most, record companies are reluctant to commit to any tour support in your contract, but are pretty good about doing it at the time of the tour. If you can get it up front, it's great to have. If you can't, the amount of your tour support will depend on how well your manager does the Tijuana two-step. But even if you get a tour support guarantee in your contract, it's usually limited to the first album. After that, you'll hopefully be at the point where you no longer need it, or you'll need to come in and grovel. Record companies have gotten pretty sophisticated about tour support. For example, some companies won't let you charge a management commission in computing losses, on the theory that the manager shouldn't get paid when everyone else is losing money. Also, if you use any of the money to buy equipment, the company sometimes tries to own the stuff. Most importantly, they ask for so many approvals of your deals and expenses that if they decide they don't really want to pay your tour support, they can make things so difficult that you'll give up. None of this stops them from wanting some active rights to your tours, such as VIP ticketing packages. We'll talk about what that means in the touring section in Chapter 23. But basically, it's higher-priced tickets along with other goodies. Some labels want free tickets to your shows, and many of them want the right to buy additional tickets before they go on sale to the public. You should push back on all of these, especially if you're not getting any tour support, and at least try to limit their right to buy tickets to situations where you're doing a VIP package. You should control your free tickets because they can be used strategically to move your career ahead, or if you don't need them for that, you could let them go on sale. If your concerts sell out, giving the label free tickets at each show is prime real estate, so giving them away as opposed to selling them is money out of your pocket. Tour support used to be non-recoupable. For a while, the record companies bought the argument that it was promotion of their records and wrote it off just like any other marketing. But those days have gone the way of 8-track cartridges. Today, tour support is always 100% recoupable. If you need it, your bargaining power ain't so great. If you're on the advanced overview track, go to Chapter 14. Experts, read on. Territory. For U.S. artists in the new to mid-range category, unless there's a massive bidding war, the territory of your recording agreement, meaning the countries where your company can exclusively sell your records, is almost always the world. In fact, the territory is usually defined as the universe, because some backroom lawyer worried that an artist might argue satellites weren't covered by a contract that only said the world. This universe wording was the cause of one of my most bizarre negotiations, as well as my initiation by fire to the music business. I had only been practicing entertainment law a few months when a label that my firm represented signed a jazz artist named Sun Ra. This guy said he was a reincarnated Egyptian, and he recorded records in the pyramids. For real. Anyway, his lawyer called me up to say that it was unacceptable to grant the universe, and that our territory must be limited to the Earth Zone. At first I thought he was kidding, so I said I would give him everything beyond our solar system, and maybe Neptune and Pluto, but that the moon and neighboring planets were mine. I also asked if we had to pay him in Earth money. The lawyer, very seriously, said this was not negotiable and would blow the deal. So I added satellites to the territory of the world and caved in on the rest. That lawyer owes me one, especially if Elon Musk actually colonizes Mars. More routine negotiation of the territory comes at the superstar level, or when the artist isn't based in the United States. In these cases, the artist may divide North America, United States and Canada, but sometimes including Mexico, from the rest of the world, thus making two separate recording agreements. The advantages of this are: 1. The two territories aren't cross-collateralized, meaning royalties you earn in North America can't be used to recoup advances and costs from other territories, and vice versa. And 2. You can always get a higher royalty outside North America because you're eliminating the U.S. company's share of it. The disadvantages are: 1. The advances may be lower because there is no cross-collateralization, and 2. It's a pain for an artist to deal with two record companies. Dealing with two companies means shipping two sets of masters and artwork, schmoozing, hanging out, with two sets of executives, and most important, coordinating marketing efforts, which means getting up very early in the morning or staying up very late at night to call around the world. Also, the contracts for split territory deals are much more complex than worldwide deals, meaning higher legal fees, as you have to work out how the two companies will share the costs of artwork, videos, etc. In addition, if you audit your label, refer back to the end of Chapter 12, which you almost always do with success, it's far more expensive to be auditing two companies. 3. Foreign labels want you to eat the cost of union per record payments, which isn't the case with U.S. labels. This doesn't mean anything to you, because we haven't yet covered that topic. We'll get to it at the end of this chapter. For now, just know it's a decent chunk of change that shouldn't come out of your share. In recent years, major companies have generally refused to sign you for anything except the entire world. So territorial deals are getting harder to come by. It's a bit easier if you start with an overseas deal, then come back to the United States and tell them you don't have those other territories. However, if you're going to a major label overseas, more and more often they're holding firm for the world. By the way, if you sign an overseas deal for the world, be sure to ask for approval of the U.S. label that will distribute your records. Creative, marketing, and other controls. There are a number of controls you should ask for, some of which you may actually get. These are: 1. Consent to the use of your masters in commercials. 2. Consent to licensing your masters for films, television, video games, and other audiovisual works. 3. Approval of your photographs, biographical materials, and other artwork used in advertising and promotion. The next section will have more detail on this. 4. Approval of using your masters in samples. We'll discuss samples in detail in Chapter 17, but basically it means incorporating your track into somebody else's master. 5. Approval of any edits of your masters. 6. Approval of sequencing, which means the order of your songs on the album. In a streaming age, this is becoming way less relevant, but as long as physical and full album downloads are still alive, you should still ask for approval of the initial sequence and any changes, called resequencing. 7. Consent to coupling and premiums. Refer back to the section on coupling and compilations in Chapter 12 for what those are. But as we discussed, This is also becoming less relevant daily. If you do get approvals, they may be limited to the term of your deal and to the United States. As your power grows, so do your territorial approvals, as well as the ability to keep your consent rights after the term. As to foreign, if the label agrees at all, they'll probably just agree to instruct their foreign affiliate to get your consent. That means, as long as they've told them what to do, they're not on the hook if the foreigner goes rogue. If you can't get any approvals, at least try to get consultation rights. We'll discuss in the next section what those are. And if all else fails, take some comfort in the fact that even with nothing in your contract, as a practical matter, the labels are pretty good about asking your consent for anything that's important. Artwork. By artwork, I'm referring to album covers and the photos/artwork used in your advertising and marketing campaign. At any level, you can get some involvement in your artwork, but you have to ask for it. Involvement, at lower levels, means they tell you what they're doing, then go ahead and do it, whether you like it or not. This process is called consultation, which means they talk to you, but don't have to get your approval. Consultation is actually more valuable than I'm making it sound, because you can at least make your feelings known before the horse leaves the starting gate, and many companies will actually listen to you. The next step up is approval, which means you can approve artwork that the company prepares. When you have approval rights, the company has to please you, or you can stop them from using it. Top of the line is the right to create your own artwork, subject to the company's approval. You can get this as your bargaining power grows. If you're a superstar, the company's only approval rights may be as to legalities, obscenity, and other major grossness. Otherwise, it's your show. When you get the right to do your own artwork, the trick is to make sure you have an adequate budget, or else your creative juices will be severely hampered. So build in a set figure and escalate it over time for inflation. I hesitate to give you specific figures because they may be out of date by the time you listen to this, but as of now, a normal, no particular frills artwork budget is in the range of $10,000 to $20,000, which is the most you'll likely get contractually. Major artists can sometimes get a minimum budget for photography in addition to the artwork budget, but it varies so widely that I can't really give you a range. Just know that superstar photographers are really expensive. And regardless of what's in the contract, companies will usually spend a reasonable amount for artwork because they know it's a key part of the marketing effort. But they may charge the excess over budget against your royalties. You should ask for the right to use the artwork on your merchandise, but this is really hard to get. As we discussed a short while ago, the company wants these rights for their merchandise. If you can get merch rights to the artwork, the company will ask for something in exchange. Typical deals are that you have to reimburse all or part of their costs, or maybe give them participation in the proceeds from merch using their artwork. But note this, when the company hires a photographer, particularly an expensive one, they just get the right to put the photos on the album cover and for advertising and marketing. Photographers usually reserve all other rights, so even if the company lets you use the photos, you'll almost certainly have to pay the photographer for those rights as well. Union exploitation charges. It's important that you not be charged with any union payments based on the exploitation, streaming, sales, etc., of records. These costs are customarily borne by the record company. This is different from union scale. Refer back to the beginning of Chapter 8 for what that is, paid for performances at recording sessions, which has nothing to do with exploitations and is due even if the recordings are never released. Session scale payments are always recoupable as a recording cost, as we discussed at the beginning of Chapter 8. As I mentioned earlier, this is different if you're signing to a foreign label. Those folks do expect to charge you by deducting it from your royalties. The most significant of these union charges are what the companies pay to the American Federation of Musicians, AFM, which has two funds, the Special Payment Fund, SPF, and the Music Performance Trust Fund, MPTF. This is for musicians, not singers. Those are covered by AFTRA, and we'll talk about what they do in a minute. The specific AFM contribution is 0.36%, meaning a little over a third of 1% of worldwide audio streaming receipts, subject to a ceiling of 0.55% of U.S. receipts and a floor of 0.50% of U.S. receipts. AFM also gets a piece of digital downloads, which is currently 0.55% of the wholesale price for each permanent download, excluding the first 10,000 units. On physical, through some complex computations that are beyond your and my pain tolerance, these payments total about 4.2 cents per physical album, excluding the first 25,000 units, for worldwide sales during the first 5 years after release of the album. For sales during years 6 through 10 after release, only the SPF gets paid, which is about 3 cents per album. In addition, these rates escalate after the first 300,000 units and again after 1 million units. There's no payment for physical singles. The biggest portion of these monies go to studio musicians, people who get a fee for recording but don't get a royalty, and the balance goes to royalty artists. If you're a studio musician, you get a bigger piece for working more hours, so be sure the producer or the contractor booking the session fills out the AFM B4 session report form properly, so you get credit for your hours. If all this turns you on, you can get more info on the AFM at www.sound-recording.org. For non-royalty singers, as opposed to musicians, AFTRA, which merged with the Screen Actors Guild and is now called SAG-AFTRA, requires the companies to pay 0.36% of worldwide audio streaming receipts, subject to a ceiling of 0.55% of U.S. receipts and a floor of 0.50% of U.S. receipts. They also pay 0.07% of their receipts on permanent downloads. Music videos get 0.55% of receipts for the first 10 years after release, then 0.3% of receipts for the next 5 years. For physical, the record companies make a contingent scale payment to SAG-AFTRA based on sales, but it's much less money. It's only payable if there are non-royalty background singers on a master, and if the master sells more than 157,500 physical units. Why 157,500? I have absolutely no idea. The SAG-AFTRA contingent scale also has a ceiling for physical product, meaning it stops after the union gets a certain amount. The ceiling is a little over 10 times scale for a one-hour session record, and since one-hour scale is currently $236.25, that means the maximum AFTRA contingent scale is about $2,375 per singer per side. Through various voodoo computations, you'll hit that ceiling around sales of 3 million physical units, so I wouldn't be holding my breath. Both unions also get percentages of money from use of the recordings in video games, consumer products, e.g. toys and greeting cards, and new media, such as apps, video games, podcasts, and webisodes. These payments go to a combined union fund, meaning it's for both AFM and AFTRA, which is called by the exciting name of Intellectual Property Rights Distribution Fund. Those folks collect and distribute the digital revenue to non-featured musicians and vocalists for streaming and some international revenue sources. So as you can see, these babies add up to a chunk of change that shouldn't be charged to your royalty account as a recoupable cost. Make sure your deal says they can't. Another union oddity is that each time a record company signs a new artist, they're required to pay SAG-AFTRA Health Plan a special minimum roster payment for every vocalist in the group. That's the good news. The bad news is that you have to pay SAG-AFTRA a one-time new member fee to become a SAG-AFTRA member, which the company may pay and charge back against your account. The current new member fees range from $1,150 if you live in Tennessee to $3,000 if you live in New York or California. Additionally, if you want health insurance, SAG-AFTRA Health will bill you about $300 per quarter for single coverage, with additional charges if you want to cover a spouse or family, though it's way cheaper than you could get anywhere else. The record companies are required to pay SAG-AFTRA Health a fistful of money to subsidize your insurance as long as you're on the active roster of the label. Chapter 14. Loan out, independent production, label, and distribution deals. Loan out deals. Loan out companies. As you get more successful, you may want a loan out company. It's called a loan out because the company, not you, enters into the deals and loans your services to others for recording, concerts, etc. This is the entity you see people naming with cute little phrases. Two of my favorites are Disappearing Ink and I Want It All. When tax laws changed in the 80s, it became questionable whether it made sense to have a loan out company, though the latest tax laws may spin the tide the other way. Even if you don't need a loan out for tax planning, however, this kind of company can shield you from some kinds of liability if you get sued. For example, if the loan out company's only assets are your record royalties, and someone sues you over a record-related claim, they can only grab your record money, not your personal bank accounts, your songwriting income, your stamp collection, etc. Note, I'm talking about your being sued by someone other than the record company. Record companies figured this out a long time ago. So under your record deal, they take the right to grab anything they can find, as we'll discuss in a minute. Also, an entity doesn't protect you from someone who claims you ripped off their copyright because of some technical legal reasons. For the lawyers listening to this, it's because copyright infringement is a tort committed by the artist or writer, so you can look past the entity. To determine whether or not a loan out company is right for you, consult your lawyer, accountant, and life coach. By the way, I'm using the term company for simplicity. It is usually an LLC, a limited liability company, which is something that looks and smells like a corporation, but is treated like a partnership for tax purposes. But it could also be a corporation, a limited partnership, a partnership of corporations, a general partnership, though this doesn't have any limited liability, a cluster of worms, etc. But I'm going to use company to mean any of these. Anyway, for record deals, it works like this. You sign an exclusive recording contract with your own company on a form that looks like a bare-bones record label deal. Then the record label signs a recording agreement with your company, which agrees to supply your services to the label. See Figure 6 in the accompanying PDF. Inducement, side letters. As you can see in the chart on the PDF, you have no direct deal with the record label. So what's to keep you from walking out on your own company? After all, you could fire yourself, then thumbing your nose at the record label. You personally have no deal with the record label. Only your bankrupt loan-out company has a contract, and its secretary-slash-treasurer is now in Uzbekistan with the masters. Well, you know the labels won't let that happen, so they have you sign something known as an inducement letter or side letter. This is a piece of paper that says, if your company doesn't deliver your recordings to them, you will deliver them directly to the record label. And you also personally guarantee that if your company doesn't perform under the deal, you are financially responsible. So the real picture looks like Figure 7 in the PDF. The side letter is an integral part of these deals. It's like an emergency detour. If the highway is flooded, the company sends a jeep down a back road to haul your ass back in. Structure of loan-out deals. Loan-out contracts are very similar to contracts directly between the record company and artist, known as direct agreements, except that, 1. The parties, of course, are the record label and your company, instead of the label and you. 2. Your company agrees to supply your services and recordings. 3. There are additional legal clauses, which are basically assurances that your company has the right to your exclusive services, that it has the right to deliver your recordings, etc. And 4. You have to sign an inducement letter saying that if your loan out tries anything cute, you'll perform directly for the record company, and you'll be financially responsible for anything the loan out company does wrong. Independent production agreements. If, instead of signing a deal with your own loan out, you sign to an independent company that in turn makes a deal with a record label, that's called an independent production agreement. Let's call the independent company the production entity, not an industry term, because it produces the recordings. Typically, the production entity is owned by a producer or other record mogul whose magic ears have found you. The independent company then takes the rights it gets from you and supplies them to a record label for distribution. Let's call it the distributor. As we'll see in a minute, the inducement letter under these deals is even more critical. There are two basic flavors of production deals. 1. A single artist deal is where the production entity makes an agreement with the distributor for one specific artist. Note, by the way, that the production entity may have signed more than one artist. We're talking only about the deal between the production entity and the distributor. 2. A multi-artist deal, also called a label deal, is where the production entity agrees to supply the recordings of multiple artists to a distributor. Many of these artists, or perhaps all of them, may have not yet been signed by the production entity. As you can imagine, this type of deal is way more complicated than a single artist deal. So let's start with the simpler one. Single artist deals. A single artist deal between an independent production entity and a distributor is basically the same as a deal between your own loan out company and a record label. However, because the production entity isn't owned by the artist, there are a couple of significant differences. 1. The deal between the artist and the production entity is now a real arm's-length record deal, as opposed to a deal the artist makes with himself or herself. This means there is a true negotiation, i.e., a deal made by parties who are at arm's length from each other instead of hugging, and the artist asks for the same kind of things he or she would get from a record company, such as a guaranteed release, creative approvals, etc. When you sign to a production entity, you should also get some things that you don't need from a record company, which we'll discuss in a minute. 2. There is a real possibility that the artist can get into a fight with the production entity. This means it's more likely that the record company will exercise its rights under the inducement letter, and thus the terms of the inducement letter are even more critical. Why do it? So why should an artist make a deal like this? Wouldn't it be better to have direct contact with your record company? Well, the answer is maybe. A production deal has its pluses and minuses compared to a direct deal, and whether it's better for you depends on your specific situation. Here are the negatives. 1. The production entity takes a chunk of the royalties and advances. Traditionally, distributors pay independent production entities a higher royalty than they pay in direct artist deals, by 1% to 2%, for precisely this purpose. But you still get a lower royalty than you would under a direct deal, and this is especially so when you're successful and renegotiate your contract. The reason is that, with success, the production entity's deal with the record company tops out and leaves no room for them to keep anything without taking it from you. In other words, with success, these deals create a lot of stress. 2. You lose a lot of control. First, the production entity will be making the deal with the distributor and may not even involve you in the process, meaning you don't have a say in the terms of their deal or even a right to approve who the distributor will be. Second, once the deal is done, it will be harder for you to coordinate marketing, promotion, etc. if you and your manager have no direct contact with the distributing record company. 3. There may be problems auditing the distributor directly. Refer back to the end of Chapter 12 for what auditing is. The production entity has the right to audit the record company, but you have no deal with the distributor and therefore no right to audit. Distributors understandably don't want two different people, you and the production entity, doing the same audit, so you won't be able to look at their books. 4. The production entity might go south with your money. On the positive side, 1. The production entity may be owned by a person who really brings something to the party. For example, there are production companies owned by major producers who will only work with a new artist if the artist signs to his or her entity. Other production companies are owned by important managers, promotion people, or industry folk with good track records. Translation, they have a lot of clout and can harass the major label better than you can. 2. You may be able to get the same calculation of royalties as the production entity, meaning at-source streaming rates, foreign reductions, etc. If you're a new artist and they're an established company, this can be more favorable than what you could get on your own. 3. And I saved the best for last. Nobody else may want to sign you. On balance, this is not your ideal choice, barring very unusual circumstances like a major producer, but it can be a desirable alternative to flipping Big Macs. Artist deal points. If you're making a deal with a production entity, in addition to all the other items we talked about for record deals, advances, approvals, etc., you should get the following. 1. You want the same computation of royalties that's in the production entity's deal with the record company. Indeed, you may want to ask for a percentage of the production company's receipts. It's not uncommon to do a deal where the artist gets 75% of the production entity's royalties, with the artist paying the producer from his or her share. Or maybe 50% or 60%, with the production entity paying the producer from its share. This percentage should also apply to advances in excess of recording costs. If you go this route, try to get a floor of, say, 15% or so as an all-in royalty. Otherwise, if the producer makes a lousy deal, you're stuck. If the production entity doesn't have a royalty deal, for example, they have a share of profits or a pure distribution deal, you'll then need to negotiate your own royalty. 2. Try to get direct accountings from the record company. This may or may not be possible, depending on the production entity's own deal. Your worry is similar to the situation we discussed in Chapter 11, where we talked about a producer being owed money by an artist when no royalties were payable. In this case, the roles are reversed. You're the one due money, and the production entity may not have any royalties coming in. This can easily happen to your production entity, especially if it signs several artists, as you'll see in excruciating detail. 3. Ask for the right to approve the distributor, if one isn't already in place, and ideally, the terms of the deal. The last one is much harder. At a minimum, get consultation rights, meaning they have to tell you about it before they make a decision, so that you can yell at them if you're not happy. 4. As we discussed, you have no right to audit the distributor, so ask for a pro rata share of any audit recoveries that the independent production company gets. If they agree, and they should, it will be after deducting the cost of the audits. A tricky aspect of this is that the audit may cover things besides you, for example, other artists on the independent company's roster. And even trickier is the situation where your interests and the company's aren't the same. For example, the audit might uncover that the distributor overpaid you and shorted them. This usually gets worked out with language to the effect that everyone will act reasonably with respect to allocating the audit recovery. 5. And of course, don't forget the points we discussed back in the Independence Day section at the end of Chapter 10, you should have the right to get out of your deal if the production company doesn't get a distribution deal within a certain period of time, or if that deal goes wonky and they can't replace it. Production deal issues. Now let's jump over the table and get the production entity's point of view. Come on, it'll make you a better rounded person. Here are two major areas of concern. 1. Remember how the artist wants the same computation of royalties as you? Refer back to the beginning of the previous section. In representing production entities, I've rarely found it worthwhile to recompute the royalties. First of all, it's difficult, complex, time-consuming, and usually given to a low-level bookkeeper who doesn't quite understand what to do. So half the time, they end up paying more than you would if you just used the same computation. Second, even when done correctly, the advantage you pick up is often minimal. Third, if the artist finds out you're taking an edge, which will happen if there's a great deal of success, you look like a pig, which is not usually good for artist relations. 2. Make sure you don't give the artist any rights you don't have in the first place. I remember a situation where one production company gave the artist approval of artwork, guaranteed release, etc., when they didn't have those things from the distributor. If you fall into this trap, it'll be embarrassing at best, and at worst, the artist can walk away from your deal when you don't deliver. Note that the artist isn't going very far. If he or she succeeds in walking away from you, they'll still have to record for the record company under their inducement letter. However, this doesn't do you any good because the record company won't pay you any royalties if you lose the artist because of your screw-up. This position is known in showbiz as sucking rocks. Multi-artist label deals. A multi-artist deal, as the name implies, is one where the production entity has a deal with a record company to sign and deliver a number of artists. It is sometimes called a label deal, as nowadays the production entity usually has its own label or logo on the product. Sometimes, however, the producing entity has no identification on the records, and the public doesn't even know they exist. Let's now assume you're the production entity and see what the deals look like. Differences from single-artist deals. A multi-artist deal between the distributor and the production entity looks a lot like a single-artist loan-out deal, but 1. In addition to paying a recording fund for each album, there is often an overhead payment to the production entity. This is usually an advance, although it can at times be non-recoupable, at least in part. And it's used to pay the entity's rent, payroll, phone, light bills, etc. For bigger deals, there may also be money for marketing, promotion, etc., and the distributor might give the production entity office space in their building, though if the production entity has an indie image, vibe-wise, it may not want to be housed in corporate offices. 2. The term of the deal is usually 2 or 3 years firm, with the distributor having options for additional 1, 2, or 3-year periods. 3. The number of artists the production entity can sign, and whether the distributor can approve these artists, is a matter of major negotiation. A new production entity will maybe get the right to sign 1, 2, or 3 artists over the term, but a more established company may get to sign 1 or 2 artists per year. More and more, the distributors want to approve the artists before signing, but if you have a lot of bargaining power, you may be able to negotiate A. No approval, very difficult today, or B. For each 1 or 2 approved artists, you have the right to sign an artist that isn't approved, which is called a put, because you can put it to the company, and they have to take it. Getting the label's approval isn't as bad as it sounds, because if you force them to take an artist they don't like, the company won't put resources behind it. 4. The minimum and maximum number of albums the production entity can deliver is also pre-negotiated, both in terms of the overall number per year and the number per artist. I'm still using albums because the industry still is, but it can mean any agreed product commitment. Budget-wise, the distributor doesn't want you delivering more than 1 album per artist per year without its consent, though in the hip-hop world, the attitude is, bring it on. 5. Speaking of albums, how about this great idea? See if you can find the history lesson. You're a production entity in the last year of your deal with a distributor, and you suddenly have the opportunity to sign a hot new artist. 6 months before the end of your term, you deliver an album and say, please make this lady into a superstar so that 6 months from now, when my deal ends, I can A, beat you to death in a renegotiation, or B, better yet, take her to another company, leaving you with a gigantic deficit from my prior flops. That way, I can take the royalties from this new artist and buy that little pig farm I've always wanted. Sound too good to be true? Of course. The deal will require you to deliver a minimum number of albums for each artist, usually 3 or 4, even if the term is over. So your production entity is free to go at the end of the term, but the artists have to stick around for a while. Note, in essence, this means your deal expires for some artists and continues for others. 6. The recording funds for the artists are spelled out up front. If you're a new entity, you'll probably have to live with something like $75,000 to $150,000 per album. To exceed these figures, you need the company's consent on each specific deal. This means, if you have the chance to sign a major artist, you have to sit down with the distributor and work out a special arrangement. Sometimes the production entity and the distributor are both bidding for the same artist. You can imagine, since the distributor approves how much the production entity can spend, which one is likely to come out the winner. In this case, unless there's a personal relationship or some other good reason why the artist would rather sign to you, you can pretty well kiss them off. 7. It's sometimes possible, although difficult, to get ownership of the master recordings under a label deal. Even in this situation, however, you normally wouldn't own the recordings during the term. So even if you win this point, the distributor may own the masters and assign them back to you down the road, usually 7 to 10 years after the term. The distributor will insist on your being recouped before they'll assign the masters back, and if not, they'll want to extend the assignment date until you are. If this is the case, you should get the right to pay back the unrecouped deficit at any time during the extension to trigger an immediate reassignment. Cross-collateralization. Remember our story about a producer being entitled to royalties when the artist is unrecouped, and how the artist went further in the hole with every success? Refer back to Chapter 11. Well, when you get to a multi-artist deal, this scenario gets to be a high-speed drilling rig. It's entirely possible, even easy, to have 2 or 3 real losers together with one smash, but not get any royalties, because the record company is using the winner's royalties to recoup the loser's deficit. Here's an example. Suppose a production entity has signed 3 artists. Assume the deal looks like the chart in the PDF entitled Multiple Artist Deal. The numbers bear no relationship to reality. They're just for easy math. Under these assumptions, let's look at everyone's accounts. First, look at the chart in the PDF entitled Artist A's Account with Production Entity. Summary. Artist A is in the red, unrecouped, in the amount of $70,000, the $120,000 deficit less the $50,000 earnings, and is thus owed nothing. Now look at the chart in the PDF entitled Artist B's Account with Production Entity. Summary. Artist B is in the red, unrecouped, in the amount of $90,000. The $120,000 deficit less the $30,000 earnings, and is thus owed nothing. Now look at the chart in the PDF entitled Artist C's Account with Production Entity. Summary. Artist C is in the black and owed $160,000, the $280,000 earnings less the $120,000 deficit. Now look at the chart in the PDF entitled Production Entity's Account with Record Company. Summary. The production entity is in the red, unrecouped, $28,000, the $460,000 deficit less the $432,000 earnings and is thus owed nothing. Grand summary. Artist A, unrecouped and not entitled to royalties. Artist B, unrecouped and not entitled to royalties. Artist C, owed $160,000. Production entity, owes Artist C $160,000, but is in the red $28,000 and thus not entitled to royalties. Owing $160,000 and having no royalties due you is certainly the fuzzy side of the lollipop. So how do you get out of the box? Well, if you have enough clout, you make the distributor pay the artist's royalties without regard to cross-collateralization. Thus, if you and artists A and B are deeply unrecouped, but artist C is recouped, they'd have to pay artist C's royalties. In other words, they can't cross-collateralize any artist's royalties with either your or any other artist's deficits. If you don't have enough bargaining power for this, then at minimum, you should require the distributor to pay the artist's royalties, and if you're unrecouped, treat the payments as additional advances against your share of royalties. In the given example, that would mean the record company would advance the $160,000 owed to Artist C, and the production entity would then be $188,000 in the red, the $28,000 original deficit plus the $160,000 paid to Artist C. You wouldn't make any money under these circumstances until you have massive success and eventually recoup, but at least you won't be breaking your kids' piggy banks to pay the artists. Joint ventures / profit share. A joint venture, which is also called a JV agreement or a profit share agreement, is the same as a single artist or multi-artist label deal, except the production entity doesn't get a royalty. Instead, the production entity and the distributing record company share profits from the masters. This means they take all of the income that comes in, the gross proceeds from streams, downloads, licensing income, etc., and put it into a pot. Then they take all the expenses of operations out of that pot, and whatever is left over gets split between the two entities. Historically, the split was 50-50, but over recent years, this has become increasingly difficult to get. Record companies are shying away from joint venture / profit deals in general, and when they do them, they're trying to pay less than 50%, such as 40%, 30%, sometimes even lower. By the way, these agreements aren't usually joint ventures or partnerships in the legal sense. A true partnership or joint venture means one partner can commit both of them to legal obligations. For example, if one partner signs a bank loan for $200,000, both partners can be sued if it isn't paid back. Neither you nor the record company wants this, so the agreements sometimes specifically state they aren't legally partnerships or joint ventures. Thus, the name joint venture is not technically correct. It just describes a deal where the profits are shared as if a joint venture existed. Computation of profits. The economics of a joint venture look like this. Income side. Gross receipts are the monies received by the record company, which is easy to compute if the distributor is independent. However, as we discussed back in Chapter 7, all the major distributors are owned by the major record companies. This means you need a different definition of gross receipts when the joint venture distributor is a major. Why? Well, if the same person owns both the distributor and the record company, they can set any price they want between the two of them. To use an absurd example, the distributor might get $100 from streaming and only pay $20 back to the record company, simply to hose you. The way it's handled is by treating the amount received by the major label's distribution division as the gross, then taking a negotiated distribution fee off that before it goes into the pot. We'll discuss the range of those fees in the next section. Foreign income from unrelated companies is treated as license income, and the venture usually gets the same royalty paid by foreign distributors to the U.S. company for its entire catalog. In other words, If they get 25% of the monies earned in Lithuania, that would go into the pot as gross receipts and therefore be used for determining profits. When the foreign distributor is owned by the same company that owns your record company, they establish an intra-company rate, meaning a royalty that the foreign distributor pays the U.S. company. For example, the U.S. company might get a 30% royalty for France, meaning 30% of the French company's receipts. This rate is in place even when there is no joint venture, as it's used by the U.S. company to compute its profits and losses in reporting earnings to the parent company. Lately, some companies have taken to paying the venture a foreign royalty that is less than the intra-company rate, so there's less money to split with you. For example, the intra-company rate might be 30%, but they only throw 25% into the pot for computing profits. They do this because they get to keep more money that way. There's no logic to this practice. It's just a muscle move by the company. So you should always try to get the full rate into the pot. Results will vary with your bargaining power. Note the result of this foreign licensing practice is that a joint venture only shares profits for U.S. sales. On foreign sales, it's simply a sharing of the royalty paid to the U.S. company. Expenses. From this gross, the joint venture deducts its expenses and other charges. They consist of the following. 1. The first thing deducted is a distribution fee for the record company. There's a gold rule for record labels. If you're getting a percentage, take it out first, because that way it's applied to the biggest number. The distribution fee is a charge to cover the cost of overseeing the distribution of records, meaning the accounting, invoicing, manufacturing, etc. of the venture. Note, this is for overseeing. The actual costs of manufacturing, for example, are charged as well. This will run somewhere in the 15% to 20% range, sometimes even higher, and it includes the distribution fee charged to the company by its distributor. This number will be higher if it includes an overhead/services fee, which we'll discuss in the next section. It's often possible to reduce this fee as volume increases, usually on a yearly basis. For example, the fee could be 20% of the first $5 million each year, 19% of the next $5 million, and 18% thereafter. At the beginning of the following year, the fee would start again at 20%. This is what you'll be charged in computing your profits under a joint venture deal. It may have no relationship to what the record company is actually charged by its distributor. And what, you ask, are the labels actually charged by the distributor? Well, before I tell you what distribution fee they get charged, let's look at the big picture. Major record labels are judged by their profits and losses, separate from the profits and losses of the company that owns them. For example, the executives at Warner Records get bonuses or get fired based on the financial performance of Warner Records. And the executives at Atlantic Records, which is owned by the same people who own Warner Records, get rewarded on the basis of Atlantic's performance. An element of the executive bonuses at the major labels is the overall company performance, but the biggest chunk is usually the performance of the label for which they're responsible. Let's use Atlantic as an example. To figure out Atlantic's profits, you have to know its costs. If Atlantic were a standalone company, it would have to make a deal with someone to distribute its records, and that distributor's charges would be an expense for Atlantic. Because Atlantic is owned by Warner Music Group, WMG, it's forced to make a deal with WEA Distribution, also owned by WMG. However, just because they have the same owner, Atlantic doesn't get a free ride. It has to pay a fee to WEA Distribution for handling Atlantic's records. In one sense, the distribution fee is a fiction, because the money moves from one WMG pocket to another. But it's not a fiction to the executives at Atlantic. The bigger it is, the more it reduces Atlantic's profits and the executives' bonuses. Same thing on the other side, for the executives at the distribution company. Typically, the distribution fees charged by a major distributor to an affiliated major label are in the 14% range. In your joint venture, if you've got a lot of clout, you may be able to get the same distribution fee that the label is charged. In other words, if Atlantic pays 14% to WMG, I have no idea if that's correct, you'd only be charged 14% in computing the profits. However, that's only if you've got a lot of bargaining power. In the beginning, you'll pay quite a bit more, as just noted. 2. In addition to the distribution fee, the record company may also charge an overhead/services fee. This is for services supplied by the label in addition to distribution, such as sales, marketing, and promotion. The more they supply, the higher this charge will be. It can range anywhere from 0 to, more commonly, 4% to 7%. Often this is combined with the distribution fee discussed in point 1, so that there's one percentage that includes both distribution and services/overhead, e.g., 27%. 3. Next deduction is the costs of operation. In addition to the costs you'd normally expect, recording costs, advances, etc., there are a number of things that aren't charged under royalty deals. These include A. advertising and marketing, B. mechanical royalties. We'll discuss these later in Chapter 15. C. per record union payments. For a definition, refer back to Chapter 13. D. manufacturing and shipping of physical goods. 4. Lastly, the record company takes back any payments it made to the production entity, such as reimbursements for promotional and operating expenses of the company. It's a matter of negotiation whether these are charged off the top of the venture, meaning deducted from gross receipts as another expense, or whether they're charged solely against the producing entity's share of the profits. It's clearly better for you if it's off the top, because that means both sides bear their respective percentage. In other words, if it's a 50% profit share, you and the company each eat 50% of the cost when it's off the top. If it's taken out of your share, you're bearing 100%. The amount left after this calculation is the profit, and the agreed split goes to each party. Royalty versus joint venture. So how about the key question? Are you better off with a joint venture or with a royalty arrangement? To answer this requires a crystal ball, both as to success and especially as to foreign income, where you're not sharing in profits. It also depends on how high the royalty rate is and what percentage of profits you're getting. As a general rule, if you're extremely successful, certainly in the United States, you're better off with a joint venture. With modest success, you're better off under a royalty arrangement. If you're a turkey, it doesn't really matter. Here's why a profit share is better with success. As we discussed, you're charged for more costs in a joint venture than you are under a royalty deal, and thus with only modest success, you're behind. However, many of these costs are not per transaction, meaning they're only paid at the beginning, as opposed to per transaction costs that are incurred for each stream or sale transaction made. Examples of per transaction charges are costs of mechanical royalties, the monies paid to songwriters who wrote the songs in the master, to the extent those are paid by the label, union per record charges, refer back to the beginning of Chapter 8, and manufacturing and freight for physical goods, which are only paid when a transaction happens. Costs that are not per transaction are such things as recording costs, artwork, videos, promotion, marketing, and advertising, which are unrelated to specific transactions. Thus, with a great deal of success, the non-per-transaction costs are eaten up by the first dollars that come in, and thereafter, the profit per unit is more than a royalty arrangement. Also, your share of profits is likely to be greater than a royalty rate, even after deducting charges that aren't deducted in computing royalties, like distribution/overhead fees. Distribution deals. If you are truly a record company in your own right, then this is the deal for you. It gives you the most autonomy and control of your life, as well as the highest profit margin. This is the deal that true independent labels make. Under these deals, you own the masters and artist contracts, so you really can walk away at the end with everything, including both the old and future albums. But of course, there's a catch. A distribution deal is exactly that. The company agrees to distribute the masters for you, meaning they get your masters into the streaming and download services around the world, manufacture and distribute physical goods, monitor all this, collect the money, and, oh yeah, pay you. For this, they charge a distribution fee, which covers their company's overhead, operations, and profit. The range of distribution fees under these deals is about 20% to 25%. Unless you're a really huge independent, then you can squeeze it down, with the bulk of the deals around 24% to 25%. So, if the company collects $100, they pay you $75 to $80. In some of these deals, for an extra fee, the distributing company will help with marketing, sales, and promotion. This is called a services fee, and it's usually in the range of an extra 5% to 7% on top of the distribution fee. It's often done with a menu, so you need only take what you want. For example, if you want sales but not promotion, the fee would be less. Note, these figures are higher than the distribution and services fees we discussed in the profit split section earlier. The reason is that the earlier figures were simply a way to compute profits, so the company was getting the fee plus a share of profits. Here, the company pays you everything over and above these fees. And now for the catch. In these deals, you take on the entire financial risk of signing artists, meaning paying advances, recording costs, artwork, etc., as well as marketing the records. You also have to pay for your own overhead, staff salaries, rent, lights, computers, pillboxes, etc. And you have to create accounting statements and pay royalties due to the artists and songwriters. If there are physical goods, you have to front the manufacturing and shipping costs, plus take the risk that the product might not sell and get returned to you. Refer back to the discussion of returns at the end of Chapter 7. If there are returns, you not only get no money, but you're also charged for the cost of manufacturing and shipping the CDs. In other words, if your artists fizzle like bad fireworks, you're seriously out of pocket. So a distribution deal is not for the weak-hearted, but with success, it's by far the best deal for you. Not only do you get most of the income, at the end of the term, you own the masters, the artist contracts, and everything else. These types of deals can be made at the highest level. For example, Hollywood Records, Disney's label, is distributed by Universal under such an arrangement, down to small indie labels who make these deals with independent distributors. A relatively new animal is the label services deal, which is essentially a distribution deal aimed at artists, rather than independent labels, though I'm sure they would handle the right label as well. Under these deals, you own the masters and license them to the label service company, who acts as your virtual record label. Usually there's a 50-50 profit split. With these arrangements, however, they want the artist to pay for recording, marketing, and promotion, and also to take the risk of physical returns. For a known artist, some of the label service companies will front the money for creation of the record, marketing, and promotion. But instead of taking costs off the top like a joint venture, refer back to the joint venture's profit share section earlier in this chapter. They instead take the costs from your share of money. Lately, label services deals under which they front the costs are getting harder to come by. That's because the label service companies have gotten stung by fronting costs. Also, even if you get them to agree, you may have to repay any unrecouped costs at the end of the deal. The specifics of label service deals are very customized, so I can't give you any hard and fast rules. But for the right kind of artist, if you're confident of some base level of income, these can be favorable deals. Upstream deals. An upstream deal is a cross between an independent distribution deal and a production deal. It works